Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Review: The New Spider-Man's Coolest Superpower? He's Just a Kid, by Stephanie Zacharik. Whenever anyone, usually a guy, defends the supremacy of modern-day comic book culture by pleading, "But comic books were my whole childhood," you can hear my eye-rolling from here to Krypton. Except when it comes to Spider-Man. For some reason, surely an irrational one, a lingering affection for a nerdy boy superhero from Queens, one who can almost fully control his web-slinging capabilities, seems perfectly defensible. There's something else about Spider-Man. Robert Downey Jr. will probably be okay playing Iron Man Tony Stark for at least another 10 years. But there's a good reason the Spider-Man series has been rebooted twice since 2002, when Sam Raimi made the first movie foray into the Marvel character's mythology. In our imagination, Peter Parker remains and always must be a teenager. Even though a good actor can fake that youthfulness well into his 20s, both Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield pulled it off pretty convincingly, the shelf life of this particular role is short. A Botoxed Spider-Man just won't do. Tom Holland, the young English actor who stars in John Watts' likable, if sometimes unwieldy, Spider-Man Homecoming, is everything Peter Parker's Spider-Man ought to be. Charmingly awkward, light on his booted feet, and youthful-looking enough to pass for a high school student. This Peter Parker schleps his backpack every weekday to the Midtown School of Science and Technology. He gets crushes on fellow students just like everybody else. This time he has his eye on tall, brainy, stunning Liz, Laura Harrier, a member, as he is, of the school's academic decathlon team. He has other friends, like fellow nerd Ned, goofy sweet Jacob Batalon, and Michelle, a sardonic young woman whose nose is buried in a book half the time. She's played with a delightfully sullen insouciance by Zendaya. The homecoming dance is coming up, and Peter Parker the boy would like to go with Liz, though she seems to like him only as a friend. Meanwhile, Peter is itching for any chance to become Spider-Man, and navigating the intricacies of that other identity isn't easy. A local trucker, good guy turned bad Adrian Toomes, Michael Keaton, who moonlights as the black-feathered creature Vulture, has stolen a futuristic substance that's easily weaponized, and he plans to use it for evil. Parker is on to him, but in trying to save the day, he hasn't fully figured out the Spider-Man thing. Costumed in his stretchy super arachnid suit, he flips and flies through the air effortlessly one minute and falls with a splat the next. His bones appear to be made of rubber. He hardly gets hurt, as long as we're not talking about his pride. That buoyant naivete is key to this Spider-Man, and Holland brings it by the jittery bucketful. The movie around him is sometimes glancingly light. Other times it works way too aggressively at being entertainment rather than just breathing. But Holland, as both Parker and Spidey, is always fun to watch. His bumbling uncertainty and his boyish eagerness make him believable not just as a crime fighter, but as a kid. And, like all kids, he's awed by the mere idea of Spider-Man, even though he is Spider-Man. He's fully invested in his own myth, even though he hasn't figured out how to build it yet. He makes nerdy video diaries of his nascent superhero exploits. He sends anxious text messages, hundreds of them, to his caretaker, John Favreau's Happy Hogan, begging to be taken out of school and sent on a mission. Happy ignores each and every one. And he eludes the stern eye of his boss, Tony Stark, Downey, a.k.a. Iron Man, who has little patience for the spider spuds fumbling. At one point, trying to foil an ATM robbery, Spidey inadvertently destroys his favorite neighborhood bodega, though he does manage to save the deli's owner, and perhaps just as importantly, its furry, big-bellied cat. Past a certain point, the action becomes wearying, though things do perk up with the arrival of a nice little plot twist. And here and there, Watts, director of the 2015 crime thriller Cop Car, orchestrates some wonderful moments. One of them is the sight of Spider-Man balanced deftly atop the first car of the 7 train into Queens, riding high like a surfer conquering an unruly wave. But the real pleasures of Spider-Man Homecoming lie in its quieter moments and in the interplay between the actors. The movie's casting is pure New York, so casually racially mixed that you barely notice it, and once you do, you don't give it a second thought. Why can't more movies be like this? Here's another sly, smart casting choice. Marissa Tomei plays Peter's guardian, Aunt May, and she shall forever henceforth be known as Hot Aunt May. Come on, you know it. I know it. The movie knows it. Her effect on the men around her, of which she's daffily, wonderfully unaware, is written right into the script. Tomei is a great comic presence, and the movie could use more of her. One of the best sequences is a montage set to the English Beat's gorgeous, wistful Save It For Later, in which Aunt May helps Peter suit up for the homecoming dance, getting his sport coat to fit right and showing him, with the aid of an instructional video, how to tie a Windsor knot. It's a relief to see a superhero engaged in deeply human activities, like getting ready for a date with a girl he really likes. This Spider-Man is still just a kid, after all, and he has no energy for existential angst. Just dealing with hormones is enough. Trump considers hard line on Chinese steel in advance of G20 summit, by Justin Warland. President Trump hinted this week that his administration may move to protect the U.S. steel industry from foreign competition, a maneuver popular with his base but likely to upset China ahead of a meeting of the world's largest economies this week. Trump announced Friday that he called on South Korea to stop enabling the export of dumped steel. On Monday, Trump sent out another warning on Twitter, making clear that the issue remains top of mind. Really great numbers on jobs and economy. Things are starting to kick in now, and we have just begun, he wrote. Don't like steel and aluminum dumping. The administration has been reviewing the effect of steel imports on the American economy and national security since April with the Department of Commerce, due to release a report on the topic as soon as this week. Analysts point to China as the primary target of the sweeping review, though the announcement did not list any country as a specific target. Chinese steel currently makes up about 26% of the U.S. market, and the U.S. and other countries have accused China of illegal steel dumping in recent years, using the World Trade Organization WTO structure. The U.S. currently has 28 anti-subsidy tariffs on Chinese steel, including several imposed under President Obama. Trump's tariffs could represent an escalation of previous anti-dumping measures, skirting the WTO process. The Commerce Department review relies on a little-used provision of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, known as Section 232, which gives Trump significant authority to investigate whether imports, in this case steel, threaten national security. A conclusion that steel imports do endanger national security would give Trump significant leeway in drafting tariffs and other measures to protect the domestic industry. It's not just the pricing, it's not just employment, Trump said in April at a ceremony ordering the review. It also has to do with the national security of our country. Supporters of using the Section 232 provision argue that reliance on steel imports leaves the U.S. defense sector vulnerable to foreign countries. Still, no matter what tariffs Trump imposes, the U.S. does not have the capacity to produce enough steel to support the country's own domestic industries. Indeed, analysts have warned that tariffs could drive up steel prices for U.S. manufacturers. Many Republicans, including many in his administration, according to an Axios report, oppose new tariffs. The G7, which includes Canada, Japan, the U.S., and several European countries, have called for a solution to global overcapacity in steel, and the European Union has previously accused China of steel dumping while levying duties of its own. But Trump's move to protect the U.S. steel industry outside the WTO framework could nonetheless irritate other world leaders gathered at the larger G20 meeting in Germany this week. The area will be a point of tension, with China in particular, amid U.S. pressure on China to exert further pressure on North Korea, which successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile Tuesday. But Trump, who has already found himself in hot water with foreign leaders over a variety of issues, has shown no sign of backing down on his campaign promise to protect U.S. steel. Gary Cohn, Trump's chief economic advisor, promised Trump would take an aggressive stance on steel at the summit. "We ask the G20 economies to join us in this effort and to take concrete actions to solve these problems," he told reporters at the White House last week. "But let us be clear, we will act to ensure a level playing field for all." Four Simple Ways to Beat the Post-Vacation Blues, by Kristen Canning for Health.com. You come home from a glorious, relaxing getaway, only to realize there's a mountain of emails, laundry, and obligations waiting for you. And suddenly, you're a giant ball of stress, longing to be back on the beach or wherever your travels took you, without a care in the world. Sound familiar? We've all been there. Returning to your normal routine after a trip can be daunting, but there are ways to make the transition less painful, says Jamie Kurtz, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Psychology at James Madison University, and author of The Happy Traveler, Unpacking the Secrets to Better Vacations. Here she offers tips on how to transport your chill vacay vibes home with you. First, plan ahead for a smooth return. Before you leave town, try to wrap up any projects you're working on and delegate important tasks to colleagues. You'll owe them when it's their turn to vacay. Tie up as many loose ends as you can before you leave so you don't come back to unfinished business that's just been piling up, says Kurtz. And remember to turn on your out-of-office autoresponse, she adds, even if you plan to check your email periodically. That way you give yourself some time to dig out of your inbox when you get back, since everyone knows you've been away from your desk. Come back early. Yes, you read that right. There's always that temptation to stretch your trip out as long as possible and sort of suck the life out of it, says Kurtz, but that can backfire. If you come home and have to immediately turn around and go to work the next day, the relaxing benefits of the vacation are pretty much lost. It's best to give yourself a little buffer, she says. Come back a day early, or if it's a short trip, travel home in the late afternoon rather than late at night. Think about what you need to do when you get home and give yourself the time to do it, says Kurtz. I like to have some time to unpack, do the laundry, go grocery shopping, and just feel like I'm ready to get back into real life like an organized and calm person. Ease back into your schedule. Booking a 6 a.m. spin class on Monday morning might seem like a good way to motivate yourself for the week ahead, but Kurtz recommends against scheduling anything too intense on your first day back. Try to keep your calendar clear of meetings, too, until you've had a chance to play catch-up. The idea is to transition as gently as possible, she says. You don't want to jump back in and have a million things on your mind. That's kind of shocking to the system. Have something to look forward to. Sure, you have to go back to work, but maybe plan to have dinner or a drink with a friend that night, says Kurtz. Or pencil in an activity that you love, like a sunset hike with your dog, who missed you terribly, for example. This way, coming back to reality won't feel quite so tragic. This article originally appeared in Health.com. More than 100 people were shot in Chicago over the 4th of July weekend, by Joseph Hinks. More than 100 people were shot in Chicago over the course of one of the bloodiest 4th of July weekends in the city's recent history. Police in Chicago are conducting a very comprehensive review after 15 people were killed and 86 others injured in shootings between late Friday afternoon and early Wednesday, the Chicago Tribune reports. The mood here is frustration, Chicago Police Department Chief Spokesperson Anthony Guglielmi told the Tribune. It's perplexing. We deployed some very successful tactics over the Memorial Day weekend, he added. Police said their review would include analysis of whether an audio system that pinpoints the location of gunfire so that officers can be dispatched to the scene more quickly was triggered by amateur fireworks. Much of the violence was gang-related, Chicago Police First Deputy Superintendent Kevin Navarro said, according to Reuters. While other shootings appear to be over petty disputes that escalated into somebody pulling out a gun, Guglielmi said. Chicago deployed 1,300 extra officers over the long weekend, and a total of 159 guns have been seized since Friday. Gun violence in Chicago is common, where homicide rates have reached levels not seen in the city in decades. Chicago recorded 762 killings last year, an almost 60% rise on 2015 numbers, and more than any other city in the U.S., although less than some when adjusted for population. According to the Tribune, the number of shootings over the weekend was higher than in 2013, the last time Independence Day celebrations occurred over 4 days, when 74 people were shot. This year, a 13-year-old boy was the youngest seriously wounded by gunfire. A 60-year-old man was also shot. Protesters plan a nasty welcome for Donald Trump at the G20 summit in Hamburg. By Simon Schuster in Hamburg. Like many of the activists involved in protesting this year's G20 summit in Hamburg, Felix Grimm likes to imagine the view from Donald Trump's helicopter when it flies over the city on Friday and Saturday. Tens of thousands of demonstrators are expected to throng this German port on the River Elbe, turning it into a living symbol of Europe's growing distaste for the U.S. president, who symbolizes, in Grimm's words, the ugly face of capitalism. In a typical year, such protests would be a routine part of the G20, an annual confab of statesmen from the world's richest countries whose closed-door talks about the global economy always attract opponents of globalization from around the world. But this year is different. Trump's perceived disregard for the rights of women, migrants, and the poor has helped mobilize a massive protest movement. The choice of venue has made the activists' work much easier. Though Hamburg has long been a powerhouse of German trade and industry, it's also known for its vibrant communities of leftists, anarchists, and other assorted enemies of the ruthless capitalism that Trump represents. This being Germany, such groups are also highly organized. Months before the start of the summit, when the White House was still far from announcing its G20 agenda, activists in Hamburg began to organize their media headquarters inside the St. Pauli Stadium, the home of a football club known for its leftist politics and rowdy black-clad fans. Massive banners in support of open borders and against the right wing dominate the stadium's bleachers. No football for fascists, says one. For Grimm, a tall and gangly 43-year-old, the German government was asking for trouble when it decided to host the G20 in his hometown. We saw this as a provocation, he told Time at the stadium on Wednesday, an earpiece attached to a walkie-talkie dangling over his shoulder and periodically chirping with reports from his fellow organizers. We had to react. And the public reaction has not only come from the local anarchists. Posters denouncing Trump and the G20 are plastered in shop windows and hanging from balconies around the city. On Wednesday morning, the front page of a popular local newspaper, the Hamburger Morgenpost, referred to Trump as a horror clown, a nickname indicative of how many Europeans feel about the U.S. president. In a Pew survey of people in 37 countries around the world published at the end of June, the most popular terms used to describe Trump were arrogant, intolerant, and dangerous. On average, only 22% of respondents expressed confidence in his ability to lead. Across Europe, the survey found some of his lowest ratings, especially among nations that have traditionally been staunch American allies. The antipathy toward Trump and the growing movement in Europe against his plan to put America first comes down to his seeming indifference to issues of international development and human rights, says Barbara Unmussig, the president of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, a political institute affiliated with the German Green Party. Less than 6 months into his presidency, Trump has clearly shown that he doesn't give a shit about human rights, she says. The U.S. is no longer an ally on these issues. The rhetoric coming from the host of this year's G20, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, has not been too much milder. During a speech in May, she suggested that the U.S. is no longer a reliable partner to Germany and that Europeans now need to take our destiny into our own hands. As the summit approached, Merkel did try to put on a welcoming face for all the delegations, including those from lapsed democracies or authoritarian regimes like China and Russia. When the White House had trouble finding a hotel willing to host Trump's delegation in Hamburg, the German government offered him a guest house near the center of the city. But avoiding the unrulier parts of town has proved impossible, says Kirsten Knight, who's been in charge of housing the thousands of G20 delegates coming to Hamburg this week. I hope the guests aren't coming away with the image of people in black clothes setting cars on fire, she says, referring to the anarchist's dress code. I hope that's not the Hamburg they see. According to local law enforcement, this type of violence may be unavoidable. During a press conference on Wednesday, police in Hamburg presented a stash of crude weapons they claimed to have seized from protesters. They included knives, slingshots, baseball bats, and canisters of flammable liquid. The city's police chief, Ralph Martin Meyer, predicted massive assaults from several thousand violent demonstrators. Asked about this prospect, Grimm admits with a smile that the protests will try to put some sand in the machine of the G20. But he says the predictions of violence are mostly a scare tactic that the police have used to keep moderate protesters off the streets. Apart from some relatively minor clashes on Tuesday night, when police were forced to use water cannons to clear an encampment of activists from a Hamburg park, the demonstrators have been largely peaceful so far. The women's march through the city attracted a few thousand people on Wednesday afternoon, and it ended with an outdoor rave near the harbor and the local fish market. Raffaele Casado, a 32-year-old native of Hamburg, wore a green cape to the rally, inscribed with the words, "Girl Power Against Trump." "He scares the hell out of me," she says of the U.S. president, shouting over the dance music that was belting from a truck-mounted sound system. But she did see a silver lining to his arrival this weekend. "He brought us out. He brought us together," she says. "That's the only good thing about Trump." A previously unseen letter from Tupac to Madonna is being put up for auction by Dave Quinn for People. In 2015, Madonna made headlines when she admitted she dated rapper Tupac Shakur years before his death. Now, an uncovered letter from the late star to the pop icon reveals that race was a big factor in their breakup. On Wednesday, TMZ published portions of a previously unseen letter Tupac penned while at the Clinton Correctional Facility, where he was serving time on sexual abuse charges. Tupac is incredibly candid in the note, dated January 15, 1995, 4:30 a.m., and addressed simply to M, often expressing his sorrow for their breakup and admitting he waited a long time to write the note because he was struggling to find all the answers so that he wouldn't leave any unanswered questions. "For you to be seen with a black man wouldn't in any way jeopardize your career. If anything, it would make you seem that much more open and exciting," Tupac wrote. "But for me, at least, in my previous perception, I felt due to my image, I would be letting down half of the people who made me what I thought I was. I never meant to hurt you," he added. There are multiple apologies to Madonna throughout the letter and admissions of mistakes Tupac claimed he made. I must apologize to you because, like you said, I haven't been the kind of friend I know I am capable of being, he said. He explained he was angry after an interview Madonna gave in which she allegedly said, I'm off to rehabilitate all the rappers and basketball players. Those words cut me deep, seeing how I had never known you to be with any rappers besides myself, Tupac wrote. It was at this moment, out of hurt and a natural instinct to strike back and defend my heart and ego, that I said a lot of things. Can you feel me? In the time since, as you can see, I have grown both spiritually and mentally, Tupac continued. It no longer matters how I'm perceived. Please understand my previous position as that of a young man with limited experience with an extremely famous sex symbol. Toward the end of the letter, Tupac asked for Madonna's friendship and gave her some advice, though both items came with an impending sense of doom for the rapper, who would die from wounds inflicted in a drive-by shooting a little over a year later. I offer my friendship once again, this time stronger and focused. If you are still interested, I would like to further discuss this with you, but some of it couldn't wait. I felt compelled to tell you, just in case anything happened to me, he said. Please be careful, Madonna. Everyone is not as honorable as they seem. There are those whose hearts bleed with envy and evil. They would not hesitate to do you harm, Tupac wrote. Let my 6 bullets be proof of that. After signing the letter, always Tupac, Tupac Shakur, he added a final request. I don't know how you feel about visiting me, but if you could find it in your heart, I would love to speak face to face with you, he said. It's funny, but this experience has taught me to not take time for granted. 4 sections from Tupac's letter were redacted by TMZ. Gotta Have Rock and Roll will auction off the full document between July 19th and 28th with a starting bid of $100,000. This article originally appeared on People.com.
8 Things We Learned After Playing Super Mario Odyssey by Lisa Iadicio. Everyone's favorite mustachioed plumber has ventured far beyond the Mushroom Kingdom to save Princess Peach over the years, traversing lava-covered landscapes, haunted mansions, and scorching deserts. But his next full-fledged adventure, dubbed Super Mario Odyssey and due on the Nintendo Switch October 27th, will be unlike any yet seen in several ways. For starters, it's the first open-world Mario series installment since Super Mario Sunshine arrived on the GameCube in 2002. What's more, Mario has a completely new sidekick named Cappy. The iconic red hat Mario usually dons throughout his quests has come to life in Nintendo's latest action-adventure, helping players solve puzzles and take down enemies. I had a chance to put the game through its paces at a recent hands-on demo, and here's what I learned. Cappy is helpful for more than clobbering foes. Yes, Cappy's biggest job is helping Mario defeat enemies and gain their powers. Hurling Cappy at Bullet Bill, for example, temporarily transforms Mario into a menacing, super-sized, flying bullet. But Cappy helps Mario maneuver around stages as well. Holding a button when throwing Cappy suspends him in midair, turning him into a platform Mario can jump on to get a boost, bound to come in handy when getting to hard-to-reach items or platforms. You can steer Cappy when throwing him. By tilting the Switch's Joy-Con motion controllers when throwing Cappy, you can alter his path, tilting him from his default trajectory to tag additional objects or enemies, say, knocking off a few extra Goombas. Exploration is at the heart of Super Mario Odyssey. The classic goal in a Mario game is to race to the end of a course before the timer runs out. Not so with Odyssey. The worlds you encounter beckon without timetables, waiting to be explored. Players won't get booted from a world after meeting its prime objective, which in Odyssey involves collecting tokens called Power Moons that fuel Mario's airship. Multiplayer will be a Mario Cappy team-building exercise. Play Super Mario Odyssey with another person, and one player controls Mario while the other maneuvers his magical cap. This incentivizes players to cooperate strategically. One player navigates through the course while the other takes the lead in enemy battles. That's a departure from the way multiplayer mode worked in Super Mario 3D World or New Super Mario Bros., where players would work alongside each other to get through levels. I wasn't able to test this mode personally during my demo, but Nintendo representatives shared those details. The worlds are brimming with secrets. Players aren't kicked out of a level after recovering its power moons because the moons are a fraction of all the activities, some overt, plenty more cleverly concealed, that Nintendo's baked in. Players are encouraged to talk to the characters they encounter in each world, too, as these denizens will sometimes provide clues that can help solve puzzles or spawn new side quests. Gold coins work totally different. Collecting 100 gold coins usually gives Mario an extra life, but that's changed in Odyssey. Gold coins now represent your life force, thus each time you're hit by an enemy or fall too far, you'll lose some gold coins. When your stash depletes, it's game over. Not to be confused with gold coins, each world will have its own currency for purchasing in-game items, like new outfits. But note that these currencies are unique per world, so you won't be able to spend them elsewhere. Interacting with everything is essential. Chucking Cappy at anything from obvious targets to mundane objects yields surprises of all sorts. Tag a fire hydrant, for example, and it might dispense gold coins, while hitting an electrical cable will transform Mario into electricity so that he can travel through the cabling to access otherwise unreachable areas. And don't miss the bird's-eye map views. Binoculars are dispersed throughout courses and offer holistic glimpses of the terrain, hoisting your view sky high, very helpful for scouting objectives and strategizing routes.
America First Should Not Mean Poorest Last, by David Miliband. David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and a former British Foreign Secretary. The first official famine in the world in 6 years in South Sudan brings home the stakes of the debate about the U.S. budget. The world's newest nation has been one of the top recipients of U.S. humanitarian aid since its birth, and that lifeline is now under threat as the U.S. Congress begins to deliberate the Trump administration's 2018 budget proposal. On a recent trip to the region, I met with some of the 1 million refugees who have fled this country to Uganda over the past year alone, and some of the remaining 7 million dependent on international aid for survival. They had a simple question. Does America care? Proponents of the administration's budget suggest that a 30% cut, taking foreign aid levels back to those of 2008, is an appropriate right-sizing of aid. But the global challenges we face have only escalated since then. Today, there are 65.6 million people forced to flee their homes to escape conflicts and the terrors of groups like ISIS. 30 million are on the edge of starvation across East Africa, West Africa, and Yemen. 93 million people worldwide need some form of humanitarian assistance. The humanitarian challenge is unprecedented in scale and severity. The administration not only suggests ignoring its magnitude and urgency, but exacerbating it. The cuts, if enacted as proposed, would cumulatively cut off 30 million more people from food aid and food assistance, effectively doubling the global famine, according to the International Rescue Committee and its NGO partners' estimates. They would remove basic and life-saving assistance, food, water, medicine, from 11 million people fleeing conflict and disaster, nearly 1 million in South Sudan alone. They would make 4 million new HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria infections impossible to prevent. They would cut off 2 million from drinkable water. They would condemn at least 2 million girls to a life without an education. They would make a global pandemic like Zika or Ebola not only far more likely, but deadly enough to take millions of lives, Americans included. When it comes to the effects of global pandemics or migration flows, there is a global community, and we are all part of it. The administration justifies its cuts by seeking efficiencies. But while more aid does not necessarily mean better, less makes better far more difficult to attain. The choices are matters of life and death. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has claimed that throwing more money at a goal does not change the outcome. When it comes to the world's poorest people, it does. This is about America's security as well as its conscience. Expanding the defense budget while slashing foreign aid and diplomacy, as the Trump administration has proposed, is an approach doomed to failure. Defense is a servant of foreign policy, not vice versa, and aid is a reflection of values as well as of interests. When diplomacy and aid are shortchanged, defense cannot make up the gaps. If we've learned anything in the last 20 years, from Iraq to Afghanistan and beyond, it is that we cannot kill our way out of global problems. It is for this reason that every recent U.S. defense secretary has argued for a larger, not smaller, foreign aid budget to complement rather than compromise American security interests. It is true that, as Secretary Tillerson noted, other countries should do more. But the rest of the world pledged a 30% rise in humanitarian financing last September, as long as the U.S. kept its side of the bargain. The UN target is for developed economies to honor the global commitment of devoting 0.7% of their annual income to aid. But the U.S. itself is below a third of this benchmark, half the current global average and a third of the UK's. I have often said that if you look at the statistics, you get depressed, but if you meet the people, like those I met in South Sudan, you have hope. We must continue to help provide these people with the assurance that the United States will respond and rescue them in times of crisis. The impact of these cuts would be swift, devastating, and felt for years to come. They would imperil lives and the course of global stability. If this budget were to go through, America would not only be seen as responsible for widespread suffering, it would, as far as humanitarian affairs are concerned, relegate itself to the second division, a declining power unable to see beyond its own nose. It should seek to disprove the global impression that it has lost not just its heart, but also its way. These heartburn drugs are linked to a higher risk of early death, by Alice Park. Proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, are among the most commonly used drugs in the U.S., available in both prescription doses and over-the-counter forms to relieve heartburn. All told, they account for about $10 billion in annual sales. But all that relief may be coming at a price. In a new study published by the journal BMJ Open, researchers analyzed data from nearly 350,000 people who were prescribed some type of heartburn drug, either a PPI or H2 receptor antagonist, known as H2 blockers. The participants came from the U.S. Veterans Affairs database, and the scientists tracked their health outcomes for up to 8 years. The people who were prescribed PPIs, like Nexium or Prevacid, had a 25% higher risk of dying during the study period than those who took the H2 blockers, such as Pepcid or Zantac. In additional analysis, the scientists compared several million people who took PPIs to those who did not take either PPIs or any drugs for heartburn relief. They found that the PPI users had a 15% higher risk of early death compared to non-PPI users and a 23% higher risk of dying during the study than people who didn't rely on any heartburn relief drugs at all. The findings remained strong even after researchers accounted for other possible factors that could explain the results, including whether people with heartburn were more likely to have other conditions or be more prone to infections that could affect their death rate. The results add to growing understanding about the risks of PPIs. While they work on the digestive system to relieve indigestion by neutralizing strong stomach acids, they've been linked to higher risk of pneumonia, kidney problems, and even hip fractures, since they can inhibit calcium absorption and therefore suppress new bone formation. But are the risks concerning enough for people who need heartburn relief to stop taking PPIs? The researchers stress that their study does not conclude that the drugs cause early death, only that the medications are linked to premature dying from multiple causes. Still, other studies have recently revealed that drugs like PPIs are commonly overprescribed, and in the current study, the researchers say that much of the added risk may be coming from people who didn't need the drugs in the first place. People who did not have a digestive issue but used the PPIs were among those with the highest risk of early death. That means that both doctors and patients should be more critical when prescribing and taking the medications. Lifestyle changes, like diet and exercise, can go a long way toward relieving some cases of heartburn. Avoiding carbonated, caffeinated drinks and foods that can cause reflux, such as fatty, spicy, and acidic foods, along with eating smaller meals and not lying down after eating, can all help. If you do need a PPI, the researchers recommend using the drugs as a temporary form of relief, not as a permanent solution to indigestion. The drugs are effective, they say, and may even help many elderly people reduce the bleeding risks linked to aspirin, but they need to be taken in the right doses for the right amount of time to ensure their benefits outweigh their risks. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.